you can't spot the sucker in your first half hour at the table, then you are the sucker.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
Oh, it's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis.
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Well, and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. Now, tomorrow, Greg Pampas on the board. S&P futures down 5. The NASDAQ futures up 50 cents. This is after a big turnaround yesterday. Kind of a colossal failure of a recovery. We'll see what happens today. Those things used to mean a lot and make a difference in trend and direction, but now all of a sudden, every day is kind of a new day. Of course, it's not like we don't have a couple of wars going on and all kinds of other stuff, and we got an election, and we've got insults flying back and forth, proving to me that maybe neither party deserves a spot in the White House, but there is no third party. I'd vote for Lou. Where is he?
I'm right here. Don't vote for me.
I'm voting for you. are you Lyndon Johnson? What was it? If nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve?
No, I thought that was... I thought that was Grant.
Maybe it was Grant. Yeah, it wasn't initially. Maybe it wasn't Johnson. He was not that original.
Let me start. I want to briefly discuss two foreign policy issues because, as I said to you in that email, you know, I've been saying for years that the best laid plans of mice and men oftentimes go astray in American politics based on the actions of, you know, somebody 10,000 miles away who decides they don't want to play ball. The first is the Israeli response to the Palestinian leadership organization, Hamas, basically announcing that its new leader was this dude, Sinwar, who, as far as we know, is hiding in a basement somewhere in Rafah, somewhere in the... you know, the depths of their tunnel system there. So, the guy that they...
Is Rafah in the Gaza, or is Rafah in the other northern part?
Rafah is in Gaza.
Okay, all right.
So, the Israelis have effectively now reduced the area of Palestinian control to a few rooms or a few meters of tunnel. They've intercepted, and the tunnels they've discovered around Rafah. This has all gotten kind of buried in other news, but they discovered something like a 3 meter by 3 meter tunnel with railroad tracks and a bunch of other stuff in it extending into Egypt, and they've shut that off. So obviously the smuggling that was going on in there was of quite a scale. So they've closed that off. So anyway, they kill the number two guy in Hamas and take him down. He was part of the group that was involved in the quote-unquote ceasefire negotiations. So Hamas says, okay, well, you know, Sinwar was controlling the ceasefire negotiations anyway, so we will now formally designate him as the head of our political organization and the guy who's going to be handling these ceasefire talks. The Israeli IDF, I assume with government approval, promptly announces, that's great. If we see this guy, we're going to kill him.
Well, that's a problem with any kind of ceasefire talks. You don't really like the guys you're talking to, right?
If he comes out of his hole, he's a dead man. the only thing we will offer Mr. Sinwar is a grave. And I looked at that and I thought, that is the kind of moral and political clarity that I think, you know, maybe only comes about in times of extreme conflict, and Israel is obviously looking at a potential existential
threat. Well, I mean, here. You can't, I mean, is this, I think, Lou, I mean, from the right and wrong standpoint, you know for sure that I am on the side of Israel, and always have been, but this Netanyahu, I think I have a real problem with the man, and I always have, long before he was ever into this mess. And the idea that we're going to hold talks, but anybody who shows up from the other side, we figure is an enemy, we're going to kill him. That's interesting.
Oh, that's what I mean. That was my
so
point.
So why even say you're having a talks?
I'm not saying it. Yeah. I'm not necessarily saying it with approval. I'm just saying, look at the clarity with which the Israelis are expressing their position.
Maybe they can have a Zoom meeting.
Yeah, I promise you, nobody in the Palestinian leadership is willing to get on any kind of a device that reveals their IP
that's what
address
these,
or their location.
That's what these, you know, these people that are demonstrating are absolutely convinced that this Netanyahu thinks that every Palestinian is a subhuman, and the guy acts just like it.
No, I don't think he believes that, and I don't think he said that. They believe this guy is a subhuman, not necessarily subhuman. They believe he's a murderous thug who deserves to be killed, and I just in terms of, you know, negotiating strategy, it again, the difference between their government and the way they look at the situation and we look at it is could not be more starkly manifest. And the point that I think they're trying to make is we have no longer looked at a ceasefire or hostage negotiations as the be-all end-all of our efforts here. If we can get the hostages out, that's great, but in the meantime, even if we can't, this guy's a dead man.
Well, my point is they never did want a ceasefire.
Oh no, they did.
They
wouldn't have paused.
They did just in time for us to give them more and more stuff.
No, they wouldn't have paused. They paused. Shit, Tom, they paused their operation for 6 months. They slowed down their operations for 6 months in Gaza deliberately. This thing could have been over 6 months ago.
Yeah, what
do you
mean?
They slowed down their operation in the hopes that they were going to get some of these hostages back because they were the external pressure. You should listen to the Israeli and Jewish podcasts and news and Twitter and news feeds that I follow. There was a lot of angst and a lot of pressure, and it's one of the reasons why those two guys left the Israeli government.
Okay, but what I'm saying is, no matter what, Netanyahu has managed to work his way through and do what he wants to do, which is wreck the whole place.
Okay, so first of all, I'm not averse to them wrecking the whole place, and as I said, you're facing an enemy with and when I say enemy, I mean 75% of the people in Gaza with a medieval outlook. And
don't
and
disagree.
So
I'm not approving of them. Well, I'm just
no. I'm just saying, you know, what's the response? The response, and this goes to something else we've talked about. Our people, our political people, are absolutely averse to anything that resembles victory in a conflict like this. They do not want victory. At least they don't want the Israelis to have victory. I'm not so sure what they think about the Palestinians, but they don't want the Iranians ultimately. I don't think, but they definitely don't want Israel to have a victory. And so,
well, they're our best ally in the world for the empire. Why wouldn't we want them to win? We don't want them to lose.
Well, but we don't want them to win.
Well, what is win?
Well, a win would be the destruction of the Hamas as an organization, and the removal of its people as a force in Gaza or anywhere else. And remember, you know, our basic, you and I are both Clausewitzians. War is a continuation of politics by other means.
Sure it is. Oh,
So every war is diplomatic. Every war has diplomacy involved. And but these for the Israelis, they want the diplomatic solution they want is the removal of Hamas and the pacification of this area, and they will accept nothing less.
Okay, but that I get that. I mean, I understand. I'm trying to understand. But when I was a Ute, I followed pretty dramatically, or as much as I could, the Irish-British stuff. And there's an awful lot of Irish people that weren't going to rest until the last Brit was dead, and the other way around. But someplace, somewhere, even though everybody now has a cousin, a brother, a sister, a father, somebody who's wounded or killed in this Hatfields and McCoy thing, someday you got to say enough and go the other way. Well, and you know the idea that Israel, everybody around them who doesn't like him, and they don't like him for some, in their minds, very good reasons, has to be dead before the place is okay. I can't go there.
Well, I would submit that the Israelis have tried living with Hamas and living with this monstrous mentality.
Oh, it's horrible. It's got to be horrible
on their borders for almost a generation.
But there are people.
It didn't work.
But there are people who, if you told me that some military act was necessary, and you, that we were going to try and minimize stuff, I believe him as much as I used to believe Rumsfeld. The body language or something. Hey, we got two guys, 15 other guys happen to be on the block. We tried our best. Screw them. You know, I couldn't stand the man because I knew he really was talking out of both sides of his mouth, and I feel the same way about this guy.
Okay. Well, I mean, I get it.
You're right. They are, quote, trying, but how hard?
I hold that up as an example of diplomatic, moral, and political clarity that we, or military clarity that we rarely see. The other, and oh, by the way, there's some really interesting stuff coming out of Iran and Iranian news channels, indicating that they're having some thoughts, and this may all change in the next 5 minutes, but that they were having some thoughts about, you know, retaliating, even though they flew the red flag of revenge, which the whole thing about the red flag of revenge sounds vaguely Team America World Police-y to me. Flying a red flag of revenge over their mosque dome in Tehran. They're having second thoughts about it because they're starting to, there are a number of Iranian commentators who are saying things like, you know, the Jews are pretty clever and they may just trying to be baiting us into an attack, which will give them the excuse to come in and basically decide they're gonna whoop up on us. And so there's play within play going on in that whole situation. The other foreign policy thing that I wanted to discuss is what's happening in Russia right now. Actually, what's happening?
Yeah, well, I was going to hope you were doing that this morning with the.
Well, I mean, and you are somebody who has more than a passing familiarity with military history, and so I'm going to assume that you know the significance of Kursk, the Russian town that is in the way of the Ukrainian invasion, and Kursk was the scene of what I still think is the largest tank battle in history between the Germans and Russians in 1944.
You know, I think you're right. Didn't it was it Army Group South or whatever it was down there?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean the Russians were driving. The Russians had finally, you know, they liberated Stalingrad, what was left of it, and were moving west, and the Germans decided to take them on something called the Kursk Salient, where the Germans had driven the Russians back, and the Russians mobilized, you know, I don't know what, 3,000-4,000 tanks, and the Germans had something equivalent. But anyway, it was a monstrous tank on tank battle that the Soviets ultimately prevailed over. But something really interesting is happening there. The Ukrainians have assembled two mechanized combat brigades and are apparently engaging in the kind of conflict and warfare that we were hoping they would be able to do a year ago when they attacked those positions.
Is this mostly tanks they had have been put together? Are they all ours or somebody else's? I mean, do we have any idea?
I don't know what the makeup of the group is, but I'm almost 100% certain that much of the mechanized equipment is coming from us. I mean, when I say us, I mean the West. For one thing, the Ukrainians have actually said that the Bradleys that were giving them, the much maligned Bradley, are proving to be invaluable in the kind of conflict that they're.
Those are not tanks. Those are the what do you call it? Like the half tanks.
APCs, armored personnel carriers.
Like the German half track almost.
Well, I mean, they're tracked. Yeah. They're fully tracked, but they're reasonably quick, and they have an autocannon, a chain gun on the top that fires armor piercing rounds, and they've got tow missiles, and they can carry I think 9 soldiers inside. But in any event, what it looks like they're doing, you know, we had trained them to fight a combined arms kind of operation, and then unleash them on prepared Russian defense positions without the one element that a combined arms operation has, and that's air power.
I was going to say superiority. The F-16s. I was going to forget.
There you go.
Yeah, okay.
You just made the connection that I haven't seen anybody else make publicly, but I absolutely believe the arrival of those F-16s has now emboldened the Ukrainians to say, okay, we can put now a combined air operation together. So they've gone around the north end of the battlefront into areas where the Russians did not have, you know, 5 miles of, you know, trenches and tank traps and minefields, and are now driving. I just looked at the reports this morning. I have not seen anything giving me a quick update as to how far in they've gone. They've captured a major terminal that ships Russian natural gas to Europe, and they've got control of that now.
Wow.
They are driving for a couple of railroad junctions that basically control train access up and down the front for Russian military movements, which will cause the Russian staff to.
And when you say the F-16s, we shipped them a while ago, and didn't you say on the show that was 3-4 months of training or something?
I said it's like 6 to 8 months of training.
Okay, so that 6 months is kind of now over, and they actually can use the damn things.
The things are now apparently flying around. There's actually video of them flying over as this one of these columns of mechanized forces is moving forward into Russia. There is video of F-16s flying overhead, going, you know, covering the group. So the question now, I think, is what is the, you know, what exactly are those F-16s doing? Because these are not, as somebody said, these are not your father's F-16s. Those things have been around since the 70s.
They're still fast as hell.
They're fast, but they apparently have taken the basic airframe, which is what we gave them, and we've upgraded the electronic warfare and the radar suites on those things, so that now, you know, they've got a radar that'll give them the ability to shoot, you know, 50 to 100 mile hits with air-to-air missiles, and also allow them to jam the Russian air defense systems. So, but the point is this: it looks like with the F-16s, we have given the Ukrainians the kind of a combined arms capability that allows them to put this thing together. And, you know, we're all kind of looking at this going, you guys are losing territory in the Donbass region, in the central part of where the Russians invaded initially. And you're losing territory steadily. They're not by lots, and you're taking a huge toll on the Russian military as they try to move forward. But you know, you really need to reinforce that. On the other hand, you know, you've taken more land in the last 2 days, more territory in the last 2 days than the Russians have been able to take in the last year.
Well, if you can get around behind them, though, that's.
So the question is, how far can they drive? We don't know. What we don't know, or what's not being publicized, is how much, you know, how many troops and how much force they've massed behind that initial front to exploit what they've done. I mean, you can't just take 2 combat brigades of these guys and just shoot them in there and say, go ahead, mess around and go as far as you can, and you know, eventually you're going to get cut off and you'll all die. So that's not a strategy.
If they can stop the rail junction where the other guys are getting supplied, that's pretty effective.
Well, And what happens, you know, I mean, it's summertime now, and trust me, having been over there just recently, nobody's turning on the heat in Europe. But what happens if they turn the gas off? You know, the Russians can't build another pipeline. What happens if they go, you know, they tell the Europeans, hey, you know, we're really sorry, but we're gonna just basically shut off your ability to.
Well, don't tell anybody. Let's get along some LNG.
Yeah, yeah. So it really, really an interesting move by the Ukrainians. It has not had, as far as we can tell, any kind of tangible effect on Russian advances in the south. But if they can support it, if they can bring forces in behind it, if they've got enough manpower reserves to do that, if they turn south, as you indicated, you know, they can start to move into parts of Russia that will be very sensitive and create some real headaches for Putin, so that they will have to respond. And then we're going to see whether those F-16s can do what they say. The Russians have been shooting, and early on they pulled this out, the Russians have a very long-range, high-powered hypersonic missile that I think gives them hits somewhere in excess of 100 miles. Which is better, if it works, is better than our air-to-air system. The Ukrainians have very cleverly, with our help, knocked down at least two and taken out of commission at least another two of the 10 airborne early warning
Our AWACS.
Yeah, they call it a mainstay, and they've destroyed two of them, shot down two of them, and destroyed another two on the ground. So the Russian airborne early radar capability has been significantly degraded. It will be really interesting to see what those F-16s do if the Ukrainians in fact have established sort of a temporary air superiority over that region, because the Russians will have to respond. So again, you know, totally unexpected. The Russians, there are a number of lessons coming out of this, but one of the big ones is how in the world did the Ukrainians move two motorized, mechanized division or brigades, which, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 guys forward without the Russians detecting it and responding to it.
They must have. I still have to believe they got satellites all over the place. How do they not know?
Mm-hmm. Satellites. I mean, you can't just electronic warfare, Tom. You can't move that many people and that much equipment without a fair amount of radio traffic. And I mean, unless they're
missing, how do you do that in the dark? I mean, when I say dark, I mean radio darkness.
Well, that's what I mean. That's so. Why didn't the Russians detect it? Did these Ukrainians screen it?
How do you put a shooter on the roof, 150 feet from the president?
Well, yeah, incompetence, or by design. I'm given what we've seen over there, I'm guessing it's Russian incompetence. But the Russians have gotten better and better and better. So have the Ukrainians, but the Russians have gotten better and better and better at this stuff and managing electronic warfare kind of issues. So we're all kind of scratching our heads a little bit, I'm sure.
Well, that's the day that turned the tide in World War One, right? When before there was electronic warfare, and the Americans, and the guy who put all this together was George Marshall, when he was only a lieutenant, where the Americans attacked in the center of the line. They kind of faked an attack in the morning. They moved a whole division on like a two-lane dirt road. How many miles an attack there in the afternoon, went around the other end, and the Germans absolutely got pummeled because they had no idea they could move somebody that fast, and they didn't.
Right. Well, so the irony here, which is there are a number of ironic circumstances, but the Russians are the guys that kind of pioneered this stuff. They call it maskirovka, the electronic masking of and intelligence masking of your troop movements and ability to move force around. And they're the guys that wrote doctrine. I mean, I translated this stuff in the 80s. They wrote doctrinal theses on how to move this stuff around and what to do. And the fact that apparently the Ukrainians were able to do this, I mean, right up against the front, because this was not moved. These were not movements in the rear guard areas. They moved, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 guys with full, you know, mechanized support, and apparently a massive amount of short range drones moved all of that up against the battlefront in the north area of the country, and then launched.
Was there a diversion?
No.
You sure? I mean, I mean, we weren't there, but there had to be. They had to make them look at somewhere else. Don't you think?
The fighting, they were the assumption. I think the assumption by the Russians, and to a certain extent by the rest of us watching this, was that the Ukrainians were trying to shore up their defenses in the central part of the country to stop this Russian meat grinder that's just been churning slowly ahead. You know, a kilometer or so a week. Gradually moving forward at horrific cost, and the idea that they would move two of their, you know, principal combat units out of that area and put it up in the north to launch an attack is a surprise. So I don't
but
think
it's not unprecedented. It sounds like it's pretty genius.
Well, it's we'll see if it's genius. I mean, a lot of people are kind of wringing their hands a little bit this morning, saying, "God, guys, you really needed that." You really needed that combat effectiveness down south where the serious fighting's gone. On the other hand, you know, this kind of looks like a little bit like Incheon, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, with the okay, you know, you've got us trapped in this one perimeter, so we'll just go attack somewhere else.
We're going to go to break here real quick. I want to zero in a little bit what you said earlier about the economics and military history and the politics, because you're absolutely right. It all comes together. You know, I always look at this from the economic view, which I shouldn't, but I've learned a hell of a lot from you guys on the other stuff, you and Mike. SP Futures down 175, NASDAQ Futures up, because I've been enthralled with the way the market has been going kind of crazy the last really month or two. You see this volatility all over the place when you start seeing 2 and 3% moves and these massive currency moves. So something has to be going on over in Japan. I mean, you don't get 2 and 3% move in your currency unless you're in a Mexican peso, for God's sake. And I've been went back to look at my book here, The Year of the Great Crash, 1929. I'm reading a lot of these quotes from these people. God's sake, Lou, people don't change in 95 years. The quotes are exactly the same. As people, as you hear today, you'd swear if somebody gave a speech, they could use these speeches. No, don't worry, the economy's fine. Everything's cool. Okay. Anyway, S&P Futures now down a quarter, unchanged. NASDAQ Futures up 8. We're trying to do something here today after a big turnaround yesterday, after it looked like we had a rally going and then new. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tamara. Greg Pappas on the board. It says here, Trump holds 2-point lead over Harris with big advantage on economy. CNBC survey shows. Okay. That's just lobbing that one out there. We have the S&P futures up 75 cents, NASDAQ futures up 1350, Dow futures down 84. Let's see, what do we have in the Dow that would bring us down 84? I don't see anything that would be doing that necessarily. I don't see anything moving more than a buck, actually. So I don't know. I guess the futures are, who knows? We'll see when we open up. We're in Europe, we got the DAX down 102. Now, these guys probably closed before we had the big turn yesterday, so they're kind of feeling that a little bit. DAX, like I said, down 102 is 0.6%. FTSE down 87. That's a full 1.1%. CAC around down 74, 1%. Again, the FTSE, they still have problems with the riots over there, so not surprising, I guess, the FTSE's down. Over in Asia, we got the Nikkei down 258.7%, 34,831 under 35,000. Hang Seng up 13 points. Let's call that one flat. Still under 17,000, 16,891. Shanghai up 7 cents. I think we'll call that one flat. 28.69. So not much going on there, really. Yesterday, Dow was down 234 after being up like, was it up 400, Greg, or 270, 370? It was huge. S&P down 40. It had to be up 60, so that'd be a 100-point turn. NASDAQ down 171. I think it was up 300. So we had 2.5% moves yesterday on the spin. That's, I say, that's not good. 10-year yield down 4 basis points, 3.93. The Bund down 4 basis points, 2.23. After these guys have had a huge run up the last couple days. Japan down 3 basis points, 0.84. And a lot of this volatility in the currencies is coming out of the Bank of Japan. And I can't really interpret that much what they're doing, but somehow or other they're causing a lot of issues. Oil unchanged, 75.23. Brent down 12 cents, 78.21. Natural gas down 3 cents, 207. So oil remains at the lower end of that range. Gold up 19.30, 24.51. Pretty big rally there. Silver up 18 cents, 27.11. Silver is the one that's been getting clobbered here. It did touch 30 bucks maybe 3 weeks ago, so it's a long way down from there. Copper unchanged, 3.96. FX, and this is where the fun's been happening. Not U.S. Euro, that's been pretty steady at 109. Not U.S. Pound, it's been pretty steady at 127. Over the yen has gone from 163 to 143, back down to now back up 146. So today it's down 59 cents, 146.10. And we have Bitcoin, which has been all over the place too. It's back up to 57,604, 2731, and it is now Thursday. I think on Monday morning it traded under 50 for a second. So that's been all over the place too. Greg, all kinds of stuff. What do you got for us, Trivia Weather Sports?
Morning, everyone. 6:37 here in Chicago. We've got, 67 degrees now, pleasant today, high of 82. Phoenix, 88 degrees, very warm, some clouds, high of 106 today. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 18 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 37 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf is 28 minutes. The Ryan from 95th is 16 minutes. And inbound Stevenson, 294 to the Ryan, is 25 minutes. Baseball, Arizona wins in Cleveland. That was 7-3. Cubs win at home. That was 8-2 against the Twins. White Sox lose at Athletics, 2-3.
Starting a new streak.
And summer medal counts. The medal tracker in the Olympics is U.S. 95, China 66, France 51. Some highlights for the U.S. team. Yesterday, women's cycling and wrestling got gold medals. Basketball beat Nigeria, the silver medal in artistic swimming, the silver in steeplechase and pole vault, and the men's 400 silver, the men's 400 meter silver. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you.
Lou, did you happen to watch? I didn't make it to the end. One of the semifinals in the men's ping pong.
The guy from Sweden.
Yeah, he came back and won.
Shot that jumps back across the net.
Well, he came back and won, didn't he?
The Chinese guy won ultimately. Yeah.
Oh, all right. Well, I'll tell you.
Did you see the 400 meters? We got gold in the 400 meters. The men's 400 meters. Did you see that race?
No, I didn't. They didn't tell me about it.
The guy, our guy was. I mean, it looked a little bit. It's a little bit like the 1500, where that kid from. I say kid. He's like 30. But he's younger than my kids. The American came back from like. Back in the pack to win it, but the American favorite was dying, and I mean literally dying, coming around the last turn, and as they head into the straightaway, and it looks like he just wills himself to the finish, and wins. I mean it.
Well, 400 is a quarter mile, right? Basically.
Yeah, 400 meters, 440 yards.
Isn't that known as the hardest race?
Yes. I think it is.
Yeah,
because it's a sprint.
Quincy Hall.
Yeah, I mean, this guy's running was just unbelievable. I was listening to there's a podcast that I really like. These two European guys called The Science of Sport, Mercifully, it's in English, sort of. But they were talking about, was it Lyle, the guy who won the 100 meters?
Yeah, the guy who just, his chest was like, what, 2/1000 of a second,
yeah,
or something?
Outleaned the guy to 5/1000 of a second. Do you know how fast he was going? I mean, he was going at the end, I mean, just in terms of miles per hour. They had him at over 26 miles an hour running, which I've never heard anybody run that fast.
Well, nobody's running as fast at the end as they are at the 50-yard mark, are they?
I'm sorry?
Nobody's running as fast at the end as they are in a 50-yard mark.
Well, that's what the point these guys made. So they said the difference was, because he comes on, everybody goes charging out of there, and everybody peaks out at about 50. The difference is that our guy maintained that speed from about 65 meters on all the way to the end, and that's how he caught up.
Well,
his starts aren't that great, but no, he's just so fast that...
And can maintain it. And I'm just thinking, what? This is like, you know, this is like some...
It's almost impossible.
Antelope or something.
When you see finishing kicks in like the 100 or 200, they're not kicks. It's the other guy's slowing down. Right?
Well, I think that's right. This guy was at the absolute tip-top speed he could muster, but he was able to hold it for the rest of the race. So my Science of Sport guys were marveling at that. They talked about the 1500, but if you pull up the highlight of the 400, at least what I saw, the final, what I assume was the final.
I'll post it.
Yeah. The U.S. guy that won it is, you want to see agony on somebody's face. He is dying as he comes around the corner. Now, maybe he was putting on an act. I don't know why you would in an Olympic race.
You remember?
Saying, oh, man, I'm having a tough time here.
Before Greg, do you remember?
Like Usain Bolt.
Oh, before Greg, do you remember Eric Heiden, the speed skater?
I do.
I'm saying, I don't know if Greg does, but he was, how many years ago? But he won every, didn't he win every speed skating event?
Something like that, yeah.
And
he was so dominant. He was like Phelps in swimming.
Yeah, and he won every event, and they asked him which is the hardest one. He goes, by far, the 400. He goes, you're almost foaming at the mouth. The phlegm's coming out of your mouth because you have to keep going at the fastest you can. So the other ones, you get to pace yourself a little bit, but not that one.
Yeah, yeah. It really. Anyway, that if you there have been some fantastic. You know, and I'm trying not to watch the highlights, but there have been some fantastic races in terms of finishes in the track. I mean, if you've had a ticket to the track events, you haven't been disappointed with what's been going on.
Oh yeah, it's is anybody going to win two medals? Well, I mean, they, in the 100, 200, but nobody wins like the broad jump and the sprint like Carl Lewis did or anything anymore, do they?
I don't think so, because the training has refined itself down now to such a point that those are radically different kinds of events.
What's the scuttlebutt? I mean, obviously in some training the things are quite a bit different, but I read stuff a while ago that if you made a difference between digging the hole in the cinder track and the cinder track, that Jesse Owens would be right there with these guys and people like that. I mean,
even with a modern surface?
Yeah, I mean, that you know, people being able to sprint hasn't changed much in, you know, whatever, how many years. I mean, it's not like somebody's all that much faster than somebody in 1935.
I think Owens was a genetic freak, and with training, like Johnny Weissmuller.
Yeah.
If you'd given him training, the modern training and a modern surface, he would have competed easily. But no, the training. The training for these people is radically different than it was back in the day.
Oh yeah,
and we know so much more about exercise physiology and you know, recovery times and what it takes and how to manage that, and then in terms of efficiency of motion and stride, I talk about an eye opener. Back when I played softball, I was playing with a group in Chicago. Our firm teams, and there was a young woman on our team. She had run track. She was a 400, a 440, and a 220 runner in college. And watching her run the bases, I mean, it was she ran completely differently than everybody else. You know, and you know, all these, most of the guys there were jocks, but somebody watched her run, and somebody said, "Well, there's the difference between somebody who knows how to run and the rest of us who are just sort of making it up as we go along." Completely fluid, completely different kind of stride, everything, and you know, just it was obvious that she had been trained on this. And as I said, it's a completely different kind of world. You get the raw athletic talent, but then you refine it and refine it and refine it again.
What are they? What they say in Chariots of Fire? I can get you a step. Would you have to be that fast to start with?
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's the marvel of you know, these superior athletes, is fantastic genetic talent, and then coupled with the mentality to win and train.
But I mean, you look at the similarities between. I want to ask you some other more important questions. Between almost like golf and swimming, is it the people who are that good at it, especially if they're not big guys, is they can almost disjoint their shoulders to where there's no... I mean, I used to be able to play golf a little bit. There's no way I could almost touch my right elbow to my left shoulder blade, you know, in the back. I mean, these guys, same way with these swimmers. When they put their hands over their head, it's absolutely straight over their head.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, their feet are all size 18. It's like they have a flipper.
Except, you know, I mean, somebody like Katie Ledecky is a specimen. I mean, she's big and she's rangy, but look at somebody like this Husky girl, Huske, Tori Husky.
Is she the one who? She was the fourth leg of the men and
of
women
the mixed medley of the mixed.
She
medley
was unreal. She was unreal.
She's tiny, compared to these guys. And yet she's smoking the field. She gets in the water and just tears it up. So,
well, Janet Evans, you would never have looked at cross-eyed. And look how good she was.
And so, size, strength, you know, all that stuff matters. But never, you know, never count out the, you know, will to force yourself through it. And Greg, have you had time to look at that 400 yet?
Yeah, it will be posted in the show notes too.
Was that guy not struggling?
He looked like he had to dig pretty deep for that one.
Yeah.
And it was only the last, you know, 20 strides or so that he really gained any ground.
Exactly.
So he hung on and the other guys didn't, basically.
I think it looks like he just had, he dropped gears. You know, what if you go from sixth to fourth and your car just shoots forward? That's what he did.
That's what he did, but I mean the last 100 meters of
nobody
that
else had that gear that he did.
The last 100 meters of that thing, it looked like he was in agony, and everybody's kind of watching him, and you actually hear the commentators say, you know, so and so's in trouble, you know, the American, he's in trouble, he's struggling, look at him struggle.
Well, if you couldn't see his face, all you see is one guy. All of a sudden, it looks like a grown-up versus high schoolers at that point, that last
year. Well, what was the year when Howard Cosell was doing the Olympics? That'd be like 72 or something. The guy who won the decathlon was actually an older guy. When I say older, he was like 32. Was it Toomey or what the hell is his name?
Bill Toomey.
Yeah, he the last event evidently is the quarter mile, right? I think. I'm not a decathlon expert. So Howard Cosell went to interview him, and he was like dead asleep on the trainer's table. He was just... absolutely beat the crap from the other nine events, which is, you know, they do them over like 2 days, right? It's not like it's over 2 weeks. It's pretty quick. Yeah. And he walked out and he had the story written. Essentially, Bill Toomey fails in the four, whatever, the 400 or 440, whatever it is. And said he came out and he beat everybody by like 15 yards. you never know with people. I mean, how far they can...
We don't have... And it took me. I swam in high school against two Olympians that were on my high school swim team, and you know, one of the great lessons of sports, and it's something I referred to in our swimming reunion a couple of years ago. But one of the great lessons of participating in sports is you get the understanding that there are some people who are just really, really good, who have genetic talent that you you can train all day and you'll never equal them. And that applies across life. You run into people who are going to be just have more talent, more smarts, more personality, more, you know, better physical appearance, whatever. And it's important to work hard and you have to work hard, but you know, sometimes there's just no beating sheer talent.
No, there isn't. Hey, I got a question for you, and this is I'd like Greg to opine on this. We have 10 minutes, but there is you talked about the economy, and I'm going to be with Dan in a little bit. I'm going to read some of the stuff from 29, and, you know, you're right about, I mean, what I see a lot of what's going on over in 30 seconds of this, but I'm going to get this other subject, is, you know, the Israelis have a bunch of people around them that have economies that are basically shot. I mean, I don't think the threat from Lebanon would be anywhere near as bad if Lebanon looked like it did 30 years ago, you know, where it was the something Paris of the Mid-East or something.
Well, you'd have to go back a little further.
Okay,
than that,
but right. Yeah. What I'm saying is if everybody, I mean, our issue at the border would be nowhere near what it is if there wasn't this massive, whatever you want to call it, upheaval in Venezuela, right? I mean, if wherever you're around in the world and there's people near you, although in Venezuela is not exactly like Gaza's to Israel, that where nobody has a job, population continues to expand somehow, and everybody's got to get the hell out of there. I mean, you can't fix it, but you know you have a problem of some kind. I mean, the Israelis got a problem, people are shooting at them, which isn't so hot. We got a problem, everybody wants to get here. Okay, but the problems are constant, they're all driven by the same thing, I think. But I want to switch into, I mean, we're not going to solve any of those problems, but I don't know if you saw the time Warner Discover earnings last night, which are, you know, were lousy, and they're down to, and they're fighting this battle trying to get this NBA contract. Yet, you know, I was talking the other day, I don't know who was on, it was Mike maybe. I said, whenever you sign somebody to a deal, 4 years, 5 years, 8 years, whatever it is, or you sign this TV contract, if you're one of these networks, or you sign an advertising agreement, somehow, someplace, somebody there, some Jane or John, has to be telling the owner, unless the owner's smart enough to ask, what the hell's the world going to look like 8 years from now? I mean, economically. Is this, we're essentially signing a deal for, you know, $2 billion or something, and for this basketball or baseball or football or whatever it is, what's the sport going to look like? What's the economy going to look like? I mean, is $2 billion going to be a screaming deal 8 years from now, or are we going to be sitting there going, we're underneath the bridge in a bankruptcy court someplace? And what I'm starting to see in this sports, just the beginning, is the people that are paying these huge numbers, the ESPNs of the world, the Warner Brothers, they're not doing so hot. And yet the people from like Amazon and those places are saying, somehow you guys screwed up. We got all this money. We're going to keep bidding this stuff because we really want this. Yet the people who have it don't seem like they're exactly kicking ass on it. And yet you're giving out contracts to basketball players and other people like, this world will never end. Now, if this market, which I sure hope it doesn't, and I'm not predicting it, this market goes down 40%, Lou, none of those contracts are going to be worth a crap to the person who signed them, because you're not going to be paying a basketball player $40 million a year if the market's half of what it is now. I'm sorry. I mean, all this stuff kind of, what do you think? I'm starting to sense a little bit of a mismatch in the view of the world of the different people on this whole sports arena. Am I just being grumpy here?
Well, you're always grumpy. Well, so okay. Yeah, you are. We're old men, Tom. So you know, we're grumpy. That's our default position. I think that we have as a culture, the West has been kind of sleepwalking through a lot of stuff over the last 25, 30 years. We saw the fall of the Soviet Union. We had a very successful, you know, decade in the 1990s where things kind of bounced our way and we were in control, and the West, you know, its ideas appeared to be transcendent, and you know, there's a lot of optimism, and I think that optimism has remained in place, even as the basis for it has eroded, specifically in foreign policy, but also in domestic policy. And we're not responding to it. I mean maybe we're starting to come around now, but I tend to agree with you. I think this is a much weaker economy than we're willing to let on. I don't see any intelligent discussion at this point by either of the major political parties. And you know, when your sole goal is telling the people what they want to hear so you'll get elected, you're not likely to hear it. You're not likely to hear, you know, the Ross Perot voice of doom about the national debt. So I tend to agree with you, but in the sense that I don't think there's really an appreciation of, you know, what could very easily happen. I'm for example, I'm absolutely amazed that Taiwan still exists right now. If I was China and I watched that first debate with Biden, who, by the way, I'd love to know who's running the country right now. But if I saw that first debate with Biden, I would have said, okay, that confirms what we thought. We'll launch the invasion on Taiwan tomorrow, because the Americans will not be able to respond. They won't know what they're doing. The guy who's supposed to be making decisions won't be able to make them. They'll be paralyzed for the first 24 to 48 hours, and that's really all we need.
Well, the idea that I'm convinced that, you know, again, I'm voting for you. You're on the top of my list. Not one substantive thing that we've talked about this morning or the last 4 weeks or other people on the show will be addressed during this campaign, and that's pretty scary.
Yeah. I don't know what to say about that, except that this is a failure of our education system, if that's what you want to call it. That the American public doesn't stand up and say, wait a minute, okay, this is all great, and you know, we can talk about people's service records and whatever, but let's talk turkey on why we are opposed to merit in our selection process. Let's talk turkey as to why our education system is producing idiots.
People who can't even, my nephew's wife, she's a math teacher, says she was charged with an 8-week program, not even 8-week, 4-week program to try and bring the 8th graders that spent 3 years under COVID up to speed for high school after they graduated, not being up to speed. I go, how'd that go? She goes, well, you can't do anything in 4 weeks. I mean these kids are 2 years behind. He goes, I'm doing the best I can, but 4 weeks? Come on. That's not the... Hey, I got one for you, though. Talk about people don't change, Lou. Here's a quote. Administration policies have made for substantial and increasing stability in business for several years. If these conservative, constructive policies of the government are maintained, there would seem to be no reason why the present economic situation should not continue. Secretary of Commerce Alfred Whiting, February 1929. that sound like what our morons might do now?
Well, it sounds like somebody who didn't understand the concept of putting a jinx on yourself.
Well, that could be. That could be. I look at the ownership and what's going on with the... But, you know, the money that's being transferred around for these baseball teams, now they're going to... they were thinking about maybe another baseball team that might cost $5 billion or something. The money that's going in that, now they've never lost, but I look at that as an interest rate going, okay, $5 billion, there is a cost to this. Even if your interest rate's 5%, you're talking $250 million a year just in carry. I don't know if any of these teams are making that much money, but nobody seems to care. Interest was, it is money for nothing and your checks for free. If you're at some level of this economy, at any other level, everybody knows is scrambling. It's all over this 1929 book about how a few people get all the dough, and their world is so much different than everybody else they never could see.
But you see that in the political pronouncements of our elites now, you know, who seem blithely unaware of what inflation is doing to the average person's take-home pay. I you know, I go up into rural Colorado regularly because that's where our house is located. And I'm looking at, you know, and you know, you've been out here. You know how far you have to drive just to get anything in some of these places. And gas at $3.50 a gallon? I mean, what are the... You've suddenly introduced a monster hit into just the very basic issue of getting around, getting to work, and being able to go get stuff. I think a lot of this is lost on the people who, well, we can just have mass transit and that'll take care of everything.
Well, you have people. I mean, I listened to I'm going to fire off at both of them. I was forced to listen to Trump the other day, and he had for 20 minutes all he talked about was Hillary. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, excuse my French here, but wasn't Hillary 8 years ago? How is she even relevant when you have people in front of them? You're supposed to be telling them what you're going to try and accomplish. I mean,
we're not going to get an improved version of the Donald.
Well, then Harris last night, I listened to her talking about, I mean, the middle class, and she's not the same person. I mean, I hope for the best for either one of them that they change their spots if they get in there, but well, one of them will. Anybody who thinks, him especially, because I think he thinks he was the world's champion in the middle class, anybody who thinks this Obama-Biden whole movement, I mean, or Kamala, or whoever was the, who was his handler from the CIA, according to Wayne, what was the lady who was his chief of something with the more security, anybody? You know what I'm talking about. Obama's, couldn't go anywhere without her.
Susan Rice?
No. I thought she was from Chicago. She was the... Wayne Manson always thought she was the CIA, his handler.
Samantha Powers?
I don't know. She had more... She was like his second chief of staff. She had more security than anybody ever had in that position.
Oh, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, okay.
Anybody who thinks that the Obama era was positive for the middle class, especially Obama, boy... Get the blinders off.
Well, no, that's why you got Trump.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's exactly why you got Trump.
So, anyway,
all right, bud. So, what do you got going? Nobody's. You guys got. You don't have any fires out there, do you? You know, like California, everything all right?
We got a couple burning around Denver, but there were two lightning strikes that set fires near our place in the mountains, but they got tamped out. We got a couple burning near Denver.
What'd you think of the idiot in California that his car went on fire and he shoved it in the ditch and started the fire?
Yeah, I kind of think that guy ought to be staked out on an anthill in the hot sun somewhere.
Where do we find people as dumb?
And it's getting worse.
Yeah. Well, did you? The thing. Chris, I was on this story. We got a dash here. One of my Valerie Jarrett, this lady we're talking about.
Valerie Jarrett. That's it. Thank you.
One of my buddies, he likes going to Death Valley every now and then. He lives there, and he was kind of kidding with all of us and our Notre Dame group, but he was going to go out there for the 130-degree thing. So, of course, I'm reading about it, and they're saying, you can't go out there, we can't stop you. But you can, by the way, no helicopters. I don't know if helicopters don't fly or you don't want them to fly when it's 130 degrees, but say, we're not going to rescue you, we're not going to do anything. And sure enough, a bunch of idiots on motorcycles decide to go across it, and one guy dies, and the other one ends up in the hospital. Luke, do we hand out stupid pills someplace or what?
No, it's like the guy who, there was some tourist out there who had like third degree burns on his feet because he decided to walk across the sand barefoot.
Well,
guess what?
Yeah. I actually know a client or somebody with one of our adult beverage groups, his mother or his sister, somebody older, was in Vegas and walked out, and the asphalt was so hot when the day was 122 that it was sticky. So her foot stuck, and she landed. She fell and landed, didn't break her arm, but she ended up getting burning asphalt like in her forearm. It was like she was tarred and feathered. They had to go to the emergency room and get the tar and the little stones out of her arm. Ugh. That's not a good day, Lou.
No. All right, man.
All right, buddy. You take care of yourself. SP Futures up 5, NASDAQ Futures up 23. We're going to go right to Dan. Dan, you with us?
I'm here.
So I'll ask you the same question. We don't normally talk too much about sports, but sometimes when it's an example like that, I like to ask all my guys, I couldn't believe last night that Time Warner is, you know, reeling over these contracts they signed for these sports leagues, and yet other people seems willing to pay more from other industries, not in the industry. And you would think that ESPN and Warner would know what the hell they're doing after all these years, and if they're losing money, you know, Amazon just having this different view of the world and Peacock Plus and all these other people, oh no, we'll pay, what do you need, $40 billion or something, and then every sports star is making that, and everything, everybody else is making the kind of money, so the skybox and the tickets go up. Is their view different than maybe mine of the next 10 years or what?
They definitely have a different view. There's no question about it. I mean, they're coming at it from someplace else. They're looking at it as a moneymaker, and I don't have a whole lot of knowledge on what is currently going on, but I do know that this has been a sort of an ongoing battle to see who is going to be, you know, taking position or taking charge here. And it's for people who enjoy sports for, you know, entertainment, a leisure activity. I mean, when you start getting into all the business side of it and, you know, who's paying more and who's going to be presenting, presenting on through media, kind of loses a little bit of its appeal. You know, yeah. It's kind of that part of the sports world that makes you step back and kind of get an overview of what's really going on. I don't know a lot of the details. It seems more of a
nobody's balance. Paid more than Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It just seems sort of a shame that this is going on, but this is the world of business.
Well, yeah. I mean, and I'll get off this topic in a second, I promise, because we got much other stuff to talk about. The Cubs signed a guy years ago named Soriano from the Yankees. Remember him? And
yep.
And the Cubs gave him this really big contract at a time when baseball was we were in one of these economic upticks. I forget. Find out the year that they signed him. Will you, Greg, if you don't do me a favor? Oh, and I'll bother you to do that.
What am I looking for?
The year Soriano signed his contract. I think it was 6 or 8 years for, $8 million or some number like that. And everybody thought, but really the thought was, Dan, in some people's minds, now granted, the guy wasn't that young. So if he's an outfielder, if he's an 8 on a scale of 1 to 10, you sign him as an 8, okay, you know that 8 years from now he's probably going to be a 6 or a 5 or something. He's still going to be okay, but he doesn't have some huge injury. But he's not going to be the same as he is today. I mean, life doesn't work that way. And I'm thinking there is somebody like Dan or me behind the scenes going, it's okay because our view of the economy going forward is 8 years from now, an average outfielder is going to be making 10. So we're going to have a bargain on this guy because he's still going to be above average. And by the way, we're paying him 8. And so, but it was a time when the economy really didn't grow for that 8 years. So by the time he was in his 8th year, he's making $8 million. And I think the actual, salaries for other people either stayed steady or went down.
8 years, $136 million?
Yeah, yeah. So
they actually, since 2006.
Yeah, so it actually went down over the next, 8 years.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, they're looking at this guy going, why the hell are you paying him $8 million? and it's like, well, by the time, because when you signed him, it didn't seem that bad that 8 years later, that, the anticipation at the time was, we're growing so fast, that was going to be an average ball player. And it turns out it just wasn't. And then all of a sudden you look at him going, hey, you're paying this old dude twice as much as you could get two young guys for. So I mean, it hasn't always been steady, no matter what. I mean, you and I know that. But it seems that everybody else, the years just kind of blend together and there's nothing but growth, right? But that's not really the truth.
It isn't, yeah.
So what
absolutely.
What is your view of the last few days? I mean, this volatility spike and...
It's been an interesting few days, right? I mean, the yen spiking, certainly is some of the reason that this happened. But it's really, to me, it's really just one event that happened that I think caused what really is going on, which is just a recognition of the overvaluation, and most especially in the tech side. But What's interesting, for the first time, Chief, I've sort of started us shifting into that fair mode rather than in that into that buy on dip mode.
Yep.
And it seemed that the way the market responded on Tuesday, you know, we expected that, you know, the rally kind of faded, and then we didn't see a whole lot yesterday either.
Well, yesterday was a huge turn
into the end of the day after starting out pretty well. And to me, that means that sort of momentum that we have has at least been temporarily lost or temporarily broken. And I think there are people who are smart that are stepping back and saying, you know, look at the, you know, earnings at 22 to 23 times, you know, look at the although some of the numbers, some of the earnings have come out positive. There really are several companies, and, you know, just a couple that we saw yesterday, like Airbnb being down 13%. And some of the companies that aren't in the Big Seven are starting to struggle. I mean, they're starting to, some of the issues that they have are starting to come to the forefront. And all of a sudden, we're not in this euphoric environment that I think really was created by investors more so than the companies. I mean, I think there's been some good news with some companies, but we start getting into the granular. And I've had several conversations with people in the tech industry recently. I have clients who work for Amazon. I have friends that work for Microsoft and have worked for, I have two friends that have worked for Meta or Facebook. And just hearing what's going on the employment side and really digging into what it really is like day to day working in those organizations, I think really has an impact on what's truly going on in those companies. So what's really truly going on is the environment that had been very favorable, very, very favorable for the employees there has shifted. So the morale, if you will, has changed. The employees are being required to go back into the office. A lot of these people who had been, I don't know if I want to use the word spoiled, but they had gotten used to not having to go into the office, work remotely, get these extra benefits, had tons of job security. And as the employment picture has changed, so has the morale in these organizations. And there are now truly issues going on with the Metas, Facebooks, Amazons, Googles, in their work environments. It's all kind of coming to the forefront. And some of these younger people are just, you know, they're not sure what's going to happen next. So, you know, they've capped their wages in many cases. They've taken away those extra benefits. They've taken away remote working. You know, there are other jobs, and a lot of these kids are really talented, but it is changing the employment picture. Part of that has to do with management. So we look at management when we're looking at companies, and really management is the key to the success of any organization, certainly to the success of eventually is the stock price. But in this case, there's so many issues that have been going on behind the scenes that haven't really been risen to the top, where they're not, you know, you don't hear a whole lot of discussion about, well, the Amazon employees are not happy with this or that. You don't hear that because there's been so much positive talk and so much momentum in those stocks. So we're going to see more employment numbers today. And I think as employment numbers continue to disappoint, or as they continue to, unemployment continues to increase, there is going to be some concern. And I think that's going to be the main issue that will continue to drive the market down.
Well, I was surprised,
Dan. At least bring some reality into the marketplace.
I was surprised in I'm rereading this thing. It's amazing when you reread a book how much you missed the first time. How much in 1929 the market had narrowed so much as well. All the guys were bitching about the companies that actually were making money weren't going up at all, and it was all the ones that were the headliners where all the money,
yes,
all the money was going to. And, you know, it was a speculative route, and the same stuff, boy, people don't change. I'll read this one little piece right here, talk about crazy. It was, I call it panic to be afraid to sell at a profit less than additional profit be lost. The panic which keeps people at roulette tables, the insidious propaganda against quitting a winner, the fear of being taunted by those who held on, all work together. It became not only a point of pride, but of civic duty not to sell, as if there was ever a buyer without a seller. Does that sound familiar or what?
It sounds extremely familiar. It's and that's almost 100 years ago.
Yeah. But I mean, so people. That's why, if you read Greek tragedy, it's where it's yesterday, right? You're reading.
Yeah, but, exactly. Yeah.
But you know, Dan,
I mean, one of the things that we learn as money managers is you can't get married to. I mean, you can't fall in love with, you know, a certain name or a certain. And there are a lot of people. I am absolutely not one of them. But that really have fallen in love with Steve Jobs and Apple and just everything he's done, and they really think he has a magic potion, and he certainly has it. It's almost like a cult-like following.
Without a doubt. It's a celebrity. Why anybody... Sorry to interrupt. I'm way too bad at that.
No, I was going to say...
Would you ever buy anything run by this Musk character? You're never going to get a dime. He's never going to pay you a dividend. It's all going to him.
Absolutely. Yep. And he's also never going to be following whatever company you are... putting all of his energy into the company that you are invested in, because he's going to have two or three others that are going to require his attention, and that's probably the most probably the most polite way to say it. But I think he's kind of spread thin. I don't know that he's really an employee. He's working for
He's getting paid like an employee.
He's getting paid, but the employees eventually are going to start stepping out and looking elsewhere, and I think he's going to have trouble attracting talent as time goes on. Because what happens, Chief, is that the people and the younger people who are the ones who are going to be eventually getting into middle management and running those companies are just going to say, hey, we're not going to put up with this crap any longer. We want to be working in an environment that is going to allow us to thrive, to provide us incentives, and provide us like some stability as we raise our families. It just seems like those companies are not providing that, and it's forcing these younger people into decisions that they have to make. And I'm sure that the good ones will find a good home, but in the meantime, there's going to be some continued movement in the employment picture as they tighten up the reins in these companies, and as they lose focus on what's really important, which are their staff.
Well, Dan, what do you, when you've touched on this, actually have a guy, I always got a guy, right? Almost exactly kind of what you're talking about. He lives upstairs in my building. And the dude he's a real nice guy. He's into, he's some sort of IT stuff. They explained it to me, and it kind of was in one ear and out the other. But the kid's talented about this kind of stuff. Of course, he has the obligatory student loan that's gagging him, the usual routine. So he's telling me how going back to work a couple days a week, and I said, well, he said, plus I kind of get bored at home. And I said, well, so everybody's coming back. He goes, well, there's no point, because I go in there, my boss is in New York, she's not there,
right?
Somebody
right.
else is in there. There's 10 people in the office. What am I doing here? But I have to believe that if ever the business changes for that company, and this may be just a grumpy dude talking, but the ability to react when nobody's there and can't sit down and say, okay, what are we going to do about this? I know you can get on Zoom. I know you can understand. Somehow or another, I think your ability to react and change is going to be a lot slower than somebody who's all sitting there together. Is it just
Absolutely.
Me? Is that just you and me being... I don't know that you can change on that. I don't know I don't know how quick to react you can be if nobody's even around or don't even know anybody. I know some of the guys here, in you've met him, in the their company makes markets and a bazillion different things. And they hired this lady during COVID. It was 2.5 years before I even saw her. And she was in risk control. And one day the boss wasn't there. She took over his job. She screwed everything up, and they couldn't even find her. I mean, how the hell are you in risk control from home, for God's sake?
Yeah, no, I agree. I've even hired some analysts where I've had those challenges where they didn't show up for meetings, and you have a CEO waiting for the analyst, and they love having the analysts and the interns come on when we have the conversations, but they I don't know if I would say they're just not taking it seriously enough, but more importantly, that they're not really existing in the real world if they can't be kicking the tires face to face with some of the senior management. I feel the same way with meeting clients face to face. You know, Zoom call helps if you're cross country or if you're, you know, it fills in. But at some point, that face to face communication makes a big difference. It helps the communication. There's a certain, there's something that's missing when you're talking on the phone to people you haven't met. Something that's missing when you're doing a Zoom call that you just don't get when you're there in person. You don't get the reactions that you can, the body language, if you will, the reactions, the in some cases the enthusiasm or the concerns don't come across quite as clearly as they would if you were there in person. And then the other thing that I've always said, because we visit companies in their offices, we like to walk around and get a sense of what's going on with the energy in the organization, the culture, and, you know, does it seem like a happy place to work? Are people are, you know, where people will be collegiate and, you know, working together as a team and having conversations and those water cooler conversations that are all so important. And the, you know, the people that run these, that are running these companies are smart and wanting their employees to come back and, you know, feel like you're part of a family or feel like you're part of an organization that has a similar mission. So those things I think are all extremely important. And I agree with you. I don't know how you can be working for someplace for 2.5 years and never haven't met your boss. You know, it's
I mean, I guess I could, the second half, Dan, you and I are going to design some portfolios for people and maybe shake some trees here and have guys do some stuff different than they are, or at least look inward. But, you know, it's, as you know, where I'm located down here is a lot of places that, you know, you got the Federal Reserve, you got the exchanges, you got them. And I'm getting this feeling that the people that have this somewhat quasi-government monopoly or government employees,
yes,
are taking way more advantage of this crap than regular people.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't think anybody's at the Federal Reserve. I mean, there's somebody there, but come on. I mean, and the CBOE, I mean, really, I mean, whenever you have people that are all working from home and living this great lifestyle, I think the place is either not competitive or we'll just raise the croat fees again. We don't care. I mean, come on. I mean, I don't know. I had some adult beverages of people from the Clearing Corp last week, and they're talking about risk in some of these stuff, and they tell me where they hire these people from, and I'm going, how does that make somebody? Nobody's ever been a trader. It's
right.
It's really strange. You get this kind of weird feeling, and the hair on the back of your neck kind of stands up, and like, you know, it's like the head of Secret Service who came from where, Kodak or Pepsi or someplace.
Absolutely. Right, yeah.
I mean, what are we doing here? What kind of point are we trying to prove to people? I mean, I a lot of the stuff with, you know, the diverse hiring and hiring. Did you ever? I don't know what we're trying to do, Dan. I mean, real quick before we break, and then we get more important stuff. But you ever watch the show Combat?
Oh, I know the show, but I haven't watched it. Yeah.
Well, when I was young, I used to watch it constantly, and it's still on reruns, and it's a real serious World War II thing, and you know, it's a squad of a bunch of guys, and led by Sergeant Saunders, and they're doing the, and every week, you know, guys are getting killed. I mean, it's behind, yeah, German lines. I mean, this is not, it's like watching 12 o'clock High. I mean, we're losing guys every show. I mean, it's not some picture where all our guys always make it back okay. I mean, they don't. And in the guys' squad, they have, there's like a bunch of people. There's like the four main characters that never get killed, then all the other guys get killed, right? But the one guy is Cage, and he's this little guy. He looks like a little French dude. And he's very, you know, he's smaller dude, can melt into a thicket. You never know he's there, that kind of thing. And he's always on point. And there's another guy called Little John, who's actually this big, huge dude.
Oh, yes, yeah.
I mean, he carries this gun that's way bigger than anybody else's. Nobody else, yep, can even friggin' lift. Okay, so he carries the big gun, and several times the sergeant will say, Little John, you stay in the back, you're too big of a target. You know, let Cage go out and see who's out there, type of thing. And it's that, that's just what people do. Just naturally, there's some people that are better at some stuff, some people are better at other stuff.
Yes.
I mean, in today's world, you'd say, oh, no, Cage, you got to carry the big gun once in a while just to see if you can do it. And Little Jan, you got to get out in front, even though you're nowhere near as good as this other guy at what he does, and try not to get shot. I mean, what kind of point are we proving today that we don't have people that have, whether you're male, female, whatever you are, if you're 6'8", you don't have the same job as somebody who's 5'1", I would hope. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah. I totally hear you, and I totally agree. And then the other thing is, like you said, as we lose people who have been some of the primary contributors to the organizations, or they, you know, played a role that was really significant in the organization, as we start losing them, how do you replace them, and who's replacing them? And frankly, who's managing this whole system to make sure that you have all the right players, or all the right employees, or the right staff, or the right combination of people to the right team, the right combination of people, and that they're working most effectively?
Well, I can't imagine in a manufacturing facility like Pullman anybody working right at home. I mean, if you couldn't go talk to the program manager, if I'm the finance guy, first thing my boss would say, hey, Tom, go over and talk to those guys in the plant, see what they're doing in this section of the plant. Well, what if I get over there and there's nobody there? How do I do my job?
Right.
Anyway.
Exactly. And I've heard that story from many people in you know, financial services industry and you know, defense industry. I've heard that story from people in a number of different industries where. And the concern I have, Chief, is that the new, quote, middle management is not, you know, big generalization, but in many cases lack the skill set that their predecessors had. And in some cases, they're just being thrown into these positions as people retire because there's nobody else to fill that shoe. So the, you know, the Little Johns and the people who were there to be there on the front line are suddenly gone, and now somebody has to... You know, somebody who really doesn't necessarily have the skill set to know who's the best person for that position or how to you know, strategize for what to do next, they're missing the ball. And I have to believe that's going to have an impact on these companies.
Well, it's
their profitability, their longevity, their growth prospects, their you know, everything from the camaraderie in the organization to just making these organizations work and thrive. And it's going to be this sort of middle management, this void of good talent in middle management that I think is going to be part of the problem.
Dan, we're going to talk after the break a lot, but let's set it up. How many, given the volatility of the last few weeks and the fact that, and I'm still, I got to quiz you way more on what do you think, this just Japan situation, currencies don't move 2 and 3% in 1 week without something happening. That's like, I always think back of the Mexicans, you know, devaluing the peso on purpose. But the thing of it is that this thing's going the other way. The thing that's being devalued is the dollar versus the yen, which is even crazier. Anyway, we'll talk a little about the carry trade. But right now, and this is not people not knowing what they're doing. This is not I sense a lot of people, especially the couple of the firms that you and I both are with. Some of the portfolios that people have really should be, in my opinion, a lot different just because of lifestyle changes. I mean, some of the people were 70 and were still working when they, you know, jumped into the NVIDIAs and all these other places and did whatever they, and have this, you know, high-tech portfolio. And now they're 6 years older, and oh, by the way, they're not working. And you and I might say the portfolio should look a little different. You know, I mean, just in general, no matter if, you know, if they got, you know, 58 houses that they get rent come from, who the hell knows, everybody's different. But I'm going to say some of that money should be in some of the stuff you've been doing with the munis and things, and some chunk of it ought to be protected. I don't, you know, depending on how much. It has nothing to do with you and me looking for business. It has to do with they've changed, right?
Right, yeah, and us also just wanting to protect what they've worked hard for all these years. And that there is some pull that they have, or some, I don't know, cult-like thinking that they have to be, you know, involved in these names, or the fear of missing out, or something that's, you know, somebody who's not telling them to protect your assets at this point. Okay, you've seen all this growth, you've seen all this, you've achieved like what is a probably good nest egg to live off of, and now why do you want to keep putting more money into these highly volatile tech stocks, why not cut back? And I totally agree with you, and I've seen it very frequently, and not only from clients and people that I've, that, you know, friends and family, and but I've also seen it just from pals at the gym that you talk to, or, you know, other guys that are in our age group. You just happen to have the conversation because they know that I'm in the investment industry, and they're kind of telling me, oh yeah, well, you know, our largest position is in Baidu stock. And I says, well, you and your family are going to really be riding on how well this particular stock does. And then I sent them a couple of, analyst reports, just sort of citing some of the risks, and said, my first thing to say to you is just to diversify. You know, if you've made money, take some off the table and diversify, and make sure you protect it. You protect it with your strategy, that, you know, and that's, I think, an excellent place to be right now. And you protect it with the strategy that we run, which is an absolute return strategy. We're not looking for downside. We're looking only to have upside and protect the downside. So that I think should be a large portion, you know, more than 50% of the positions of people who are just about retiring, at retirement, will expect to see less income going forward and really want to preserve what they've worked hard for.
Well, Dan, let's dash off the break. We've got a big spike in these spoos here, up 33, NASDAQ up 150 as these jobless claim numbers came out. They're right where it's supposed to be, 235. I don't know how that's market moving, but somehow it is for the moment. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices, along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com, PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Rick Pappas on the board. S&P futures now up 31. We set a spike up here. NASDAQ futures up 150. So we're going to make it another chance at going up today. Again, we're going to talk to Dan a second after we worried about this rally after yesterday's got turned around pretty bad. Dow futures are still down 46. We don't know why that is because I got most of the stuff in the Dow here. It looks green to me. Amazon up a buck and a quarter. Apple up 124. Goldman Sachs up $4. So, and Microsoft up $4. It tries to make a comeback as well. We have the rest of the stuff here. I'll get the, there we go. Over in Europe, they were down earlier. Let's see, they're still down, but not as much. They were down, the DAX was down a full percent. Now it's only down 87 points. That's a half a percent. FTSE down 91. That's 1.1%. We'll talk a little bit tomorrow, a little bit on the London riots or the riots in Europe, Britain. It's still, those are pretty bad. CAC around down 72. That's a full 1%. Thank God there's been no riots over Paris. The Olympics have been pretty good. Matter of fact, they've been real good. Nikkei down 258.7%. 34,831. Hang Seng up 13, let's call that flat, 16,891. Hang Seng up 7 cents, let's really call that flat, 28.99. Yesterday, we were up really strong most of the morning. Dow finished down 234, S&P's down 40, NASDAQ down 171. I want to say the S&P at one point was up 80, so it was almost a 2.1% spin around. Not good. Bonds up 2 basis points, 399. The Bund down 1 basis point, 226. Japan and down 2 basis points, 0.84. Oil, surely at the low end of the range. Actually, it was a little lower the other day at 72, but it's back up to 75.10, even though it's down 13 cents this morning. Brent down 22 cents, 78.11. Natural gas down 5 cents, 206, but it's over 2 bucks. I think it might have ducked under that yesterday. RBOB unchanged at 236. Gold, pretty good rally here, up 20 bucks, 24.52. Silver up 19 cents, 27.13, but still a long way below the high, where it was 30 bucks a couple weeks ago. Copper up a penny, 3.96. Foreign exchange, 109 against the euro, so steady there. 126.8 against the pound, pretty steady there. Japan up to 146.94, I mean down to 146.94. That was 163, 143, now 147, say. So that's where the volatility is coming in the currency markets. Crypto, Bitcoin up 3,500 now, 58,401. It was like 60,000 2 weeks ago, traded under 50 on Monday morning, now it's back to 58. There's some volatility. Greg, what do you got for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
Morning, everyone. It is 7:35 a.m. here in Chicago. We have 67 degrees and sunny right now, pleasant today, and a high of 82. Phoenix is 85. It's cloudy, and the air quality is poor. So very warm and some clouds, high of 106 today. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose is 28 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 47 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 33 minutes. Ryan from 95th is 22 minutes, and the Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 32 minutes. Baseball, Arizona wins in Cleveland, that was 7-3. Cubs win at home, 8-2. White Sox lose, that was 2-3. And the Olympic medal count, U.S. 95, China 66, France 51. Some highlights, gold for men in the 400 meter, women's cycling and wrestling. Women's basketball.
Did you watch any of the women's wrestling? That's a little weird.
I missed that one. Women's basketball beat Nigeria, and we had a silver in the steeplechase and women's pole vault. So that's all I got. Back to you.
Dan, did you watch? I started the conversation with Lou about, I was watching men's ping pong. There's a guy from Sweden playing a guy from Japan, I think. I don't know these guys from anywhere. Every time the Japanese guy got a point, he lets out this guttural yell. And I'm going, after watching 20 points of this, I was so anxious for that guy to lose. Now, is that nice of me or not? Yeah. I could not, if I'm the opponent having to listen to that every time the guy got a point, what is he doing?
Yeah. I did competitive judo for about 10 years, and they call it kiai when you yell, and it's done to throw off your opponent. So that guttural sound that you're hearing is a way of tensing the other person's body up. Ah. So it's, you know, you're supposed to be relaxed, say, in ping pong too, right? You're not supposed to be tense when you're playing. That's one of those games that you want to be very relaxed, and it's a way of it's a little bit of a strategy of tensing the other guy's body. And in judo, it would be what you do once your opponent's body is tense, then you can throw them. You know, it just makes it. Yeah, so that's intentional.
But it was aggravating. But there's not 60.
You don't expect to see it in ping pong, right?
Well, there's not 60 points in judo. You're not going to do it 60 times.
Yeah, exactly.
It was getting a little old. Anyway.
Right.
But, man, we've got, what is, from a technical standpoint, what does a day like yesterday tell you, the big kind of reversal? I mean, are we going, of course, yesterday morning, if you were listening to the radio, TV, God bless, everybody knows this was just a minor correction. Get back in there. The Fed was going to cut by half a point and all will be well. I mean, the soothing balm that was flowing all over your head, and all of a sudden the market absolutely turns around in the afternoon. Everybody's like, well, everybody expected it, right? I'm listening to this gibberish, and I can't even, basically, I don't think anybody knows what's happening right here. And I don't know that a half a point solves all the problems of the world. It doesn't solve anybody. Problems that I know of, but what from a technical point, and I'm no technical dude, is yesterday a big fiasco? If it happens again today, what does that tell you about them? Right now, it looks like we're pretty strong, but who's happier? The guys that where the market's up, or the guys that are looking to sell and now get to sell it up? I mean, who's the happiest here?
Yeah, I think I know the people who aren't the happiest are the people that have been in for the long run that have been really concerned about what's going on this week. We are probably the happiest because our strategies are looking very good relative to the volatility that we're seeing in the in the market. So this has been very good for us. We've also seen rates come down. So for bonds, it's actually been a good period. There's I think what people need to remember is, and I think oftentimes they forget because they just kind of look at the bond market as a one-off, but we're still getting really attractive yields on the 1 to 2 month T-bills. They're still, you know, 535, 540. These are off the run. Munis still look very attractive. So, you know, there's still opportunity there. So bonds, this has actually been a very good period for bonds. It's been a great period for your protected strategy because it's a way of tempering the volatility and again, holding on to those gains that people have worked so hard for. What does happen, though, that I think some investors don't totally understand and some listeners may not totally understand, people buy treasuries when there's a flight to quality. So this is one of the great things about economics. This is what I really like about economics. So think of it, Chief, that there are buyers there because they're concerned that this volatility is going to continue. Well, there's a natural balancing effect that occurs. So it occurs as more people buy treasuries, the yields go down. Well, the yields go down also when we're anticipating a slowdown in the economy. However, what's happening is lower yields are going to make mortgage rates more attractive. They're going to make the cost of capital for companies more attractive. So they're good to individuals. Lower rates are good for companies. Lower rates are good for tech stocks. Lower rates are good for mortgages. So the interesting thing is that we have this system in economics, this natural balancing, if you will, when we do have a flight to quality, when we do have rates come down, that helps the equity markets, that helps the individuals. And this is part of the plan, if you will. This is what is supposed to happen at this part of the economic cycle. And it's supposed to happen slowly as it has. It's not supposed to be all at once. But that you have to put aside because that's what's going on in the background. And that's the main thing that's going on. And then trying to look at this day-to-day volatility, especially in the tech stocks, you know, or this movement that seems to be hypersensitive to certain pieces of news. And to me, that generally happens before, you know, we're gonna head in a longer term downturn. Like, in other words, have we already reached the peak? Are we gonna continue to sell off more rapidly as time goes on? And I don't think I have an answer to that. My short-term answer would be to still, like others are saying, buy on dips. A lot of the talking heads will get on the Bloomberg and the CNBC shows and talk about, you know, buying quality. You know, if I hear one more person get on and say, oh, we only buy high quality, I mean, that, of course, you know, that's where you want to be.
Intel, but, was Intel high quality?
You know, that's a very good question. That's kind of what I always say, too. There's a lot of lingo that's used, right, that doesn't really help the listener or the average investor know what that really means. It would be companies that don't have a lot of debt on their balance sheet. It would be companies that, well, they're well-capitalized, that have some operating history. There'd be companies that, you know, possibly pay a dividend, and if they do, that they're not talking about cutting it. It would be companies that, you know, are focusing on free cash flow, and as you see an increase in free cash flow, that would be positive. Companies that are well-managed, but that's, you know, it's a little bit difficult to describe specifically what they're referring to. It's just sort of I say it's a catch-all phrase. But I think the good news for investors is that when we do see this cycle of softness, it does have there is a mechanism that actually comes back to help the economy, and that lower rates are going to help not only stocks and companies in general and the cost of capital and mortgages and all that. It's just going to be, you know, there are some benefits to this happening. So it just takes time and patience. And I think for the investors who've been patient in this environment, they've done well. But if we go back to what we've been saying, and I can't kick the table even anymore, that this has been a period to absolutely take advantage of selling at some of the high points here, diversifying into more risk, you know, risk management into your portfolio, capturing the gains that you've made, putting them in a protected strategy, putting them in bonds, still getting decent returns in both of those, and not worrying about catching that last little upside.
Well,
that last little bit of upside.
Dan, how much I mean, what you just said, there's no argument theoretically or logically with any of it. Do you get the feeling like I do that some of the logic that you and I learned is sort of not there? I mean, you're never going to get me to argue that lowering interest rates shouldn't be beneficial for a lot of spots. Yet, we had a Fed that went down to zero. It didn't affect anybody on credit cards. I don't think it helped people on mortgages. I'll roll with that one. But then all it really did was run the price of the house up, so your net wasn't any better. But I mean, in terms of would the mid management company, actually the companies I'm talking about of a don't take this wrong. You don't get down this low. I don't think are investing in like a big heating and air conditioning company or a big plumbing company or something. You're way above that, right? So I know you are. So my point is, I don't think those guys ever got the 2% borrowing, 3% borrowing that other people got. I think the new truck was still going to be 7-8% for them. Maybe with the guy even have to sign the loan personally, which he never used to have to do. Thank you, Dodd-Frank. I mean, I don't know that the theory that you and I can recite pretty well because we both paid attention in class, I'm not so sure half of that applies today. You know, that all of a sudden, you know, other than the market itself, that the Fed's going to help anybody by dropping it 0.5%. I don't have anything on a credit card, but if I did, I wouldn't. I mean, what did Nancy say 2 weeks ago? Somebody went out and got a new credit card and her credit history isn't so good. The guy's paying 36%. Now, if these guys cut rates next week, you think he's going to get the next statement saying he's 32? I doubt it. I mean,
eventually there'll be another credit card company that will charge a lower rate, just like there'll be another grocery store that you know, when we've had this inflation, that will offer some sales of some items at lower prices. And again, going back to, I mean, that's what we want to think, right? And that's what the theory of capitalism is, and the theory of our American system, that there is competition that comes in that will undercut, and there's an opportunity for that to happen. Whether or not it happens is another story, but there'll be an opportunity as rates come lower to start seeing, you know, say, for example, to use your analogy, a credit card company offering rates, lower rates. So I think it takes time to get to that point. It doesn't generally happen right at first. Same thing with mortgage rates. You know, there's this overlap period. You know, when mortgage rates come down, it's not on the first day that you can get a lower mortgage. It's generally...
It's pretty quick in mortgages.
Yeah, but there are times where, depending on which mortgage company you're going to, they're going to offer another rate, but then they're forced to bring their rates down because the other companies are doing it as well.
Well, Dan, how many... I'm asking because I don't know the answer. If Capital One, I don't know what the status of that takeover between them and Discover, did they bag that because of antitrust issues, or is that still on?
I think that's still going on, yeah.
If they took over Discover, how many real players are there? There's Citi, there's Capital One, there's Chase, and who else?
True. And that's the problem, is that there's... And then the barriers to entry to getting into that business are really high. So that becomes the other obstacle, is when you have monopolies or oligopolies. You know, when you have, we only have a small number of companies running an industry, that's when it becomes tough. Same thing, obviously, in tech. I mean, any business where there's a high barrier to entry is going to be. But the flip side of that is there will be a way that there'll be a smaller company or another service, and I think we just have to have faith that that's going to happen, because it has happened in certain industries. And if there's a company that's failing because of management or because they didn't have the right strategy, there'll be another company that'll come along and hopefully do it better.
Because I did seat of the pants study, and I think the years I used were 2010 to 20, or whenever the rates went from... When they got down to zero, maybe I did the 10 years before that. Then the T-bill rates or the federal funds rates went from, like, you know, 4 down to zero. And I had credit card rates actually went up in that period of time. Because
that's the amazing thing that consumers are faced with that. I you know, my knee-jerk reaction to people is not to rely on the credit cards. You know, if you can, if you know, in terms of financial planning, even though I'm a bond manager, try to get your debt level down, especially as you get older and depending on what your income level is at a certain time. I mean, there's a time, you know, it's kind of a lifestyle thing. There's a certain point in your time, in your life that, you know, buying the home and having the family and all that, that's a time to have mortgage when you may have two incomes even, or when your income is at a high level if you're the primary breadwinner. But then as time goes on, try to pay that mortgage down so that you're not having mortgages, you know, a mortgage when you're in your 80s. And I'm not criticizing for anybody who does that, but it's just one less thing you have to be concerned about.
Well, Dan, what if somebody, and I think people probably at least have an inclination toward it, if somebody ever wants to use Dan's services or ours here at PTI, or Wall Street Advisors, my advisor firm, we can make that happen. I mean, and I think the warning I have to give out, and the warning is, Dan, we started the business, when I say PTI, if you wandered in with a check, I'm going to say at noon, we had your account up and running and you could trade at 2.
Yes.
That ship has sailed. It is incredible, especially if you're transferring from another place. Companies are allowed, because, you know, if you're big enough, you can do whatever you damn well please, it seems, in this world. They're allowed to really hang on to your stuff really, really a long time. Or even if you say you want to switch it over to someplace like us, they are, you know, we either Interactive Brokers or our platform there, RBC, because we have two clearing firms. Well, the thing that I would recommend, especially for people who like to do a lot of trading on their own, PTI's ProDirect platform, which essentially uses IB. Both my investment advisor firm and Dan's are very connected to that IB platform. So if somebody, for instance, said, look, I don't know what the world's going to look like in 6 months, 3 months, a year, I'm going to put myself in a spot where if I ever wanted you know, Dan or Tom to help me out, but still wanted to trade my own and a lot of the other stuff, This IB platform is perfect, because you could put, you know, say you're huge, you put $10 million in there. Not saying that's our minimum or anything like that, because it isn't. You put some money in there and say after 2 years, the world's changed. You know what? I still want to do a lot on my own, but how about putting, you know, $2 million with Dan and let him do what he does best? And by the way, he's having a great year. I'll say that, even though you didn't, Dan. And we'll put the rest over where, you know, where the chief does his protected thing, and we'll pick the indexes we like, and we'll. Or maybe we'll do some of the metals, whatever anybody wants to do. Or I seem to have an awful lot of this one stock. It's a concentration issue. I know this chief dude's really good at that. I'll let him do that. You can pick and choose, and you can do it in a day or a week. I mean, right now, Dan, we're trying to get one of listeners and a friend has on one of these annuities where there's some of it's life insurance, some of it's market. It becomes more and more market over time and whatever. And he wants out of there. He wants to be in a protected thing, and wants to be able to call. Dan, the hoops we are having to jump through to get this money out is absolutely incredible. I mean, we're still doing it. We'll get it. I mean, we're like terriers. I mean, we'll eventually, you know, do the right thing, because, you know, the person's a client and a friend. But I mean, what a pain in the ass. And all this stuff is coming out of the Department of Labor. If you switch an IRA now, the person who takes it has to prove that he's lower cost and going to do a better job than the guy who had it. Who the hell gets to do that? Where does that come from?
Yeah, I mean, some of it comes from some of the, you know, litigation that we've seen from people charging fees that are too high. Certainly with an annuity that, you know, it works for some people, but it also, the fees tend to be very high on annuities. Don't have the flexibility, you don't have the ability to take out your assets when you need to. And as you're saying, they're very hard to get out of, they're very hard to unwind, and yet holding on to them is going to restrict the amount of money that you'll have that'll actually be liquid as time goes on. So it's, you know, they're not as attractive as as the story tells initially, and they may have a place in some people's portfolios, but over time with annuities, I think you're paying more, and I think there's the ability to have more flexibility and to have better returns, and also to have your assets protected And then to have liquidity if you need it. If there's a point where you really need the money, you have much better access to it than if it's tied up in an annuity.
I guess the point I'm trying to make then is if somebody sees any time in the future, either they don't, they want to stop doing a lot of their own stuff, or they're going to take a wild around the world cruise and want, you know, a couple of guys that they trust. I assume they trust us. I don't know why they wouldn't. And they want us to take. You have to plan for that now. You can't just do it in a minute. Is I guess my point here.
Yeah, no, that's very true. You do have to plan for it, and there is, you know, a certain amount of security. Well, the good thing about the amount of security, in order to avoid things like cybersecurity issues, it's actually a good thing. It's a little bit tedious, but at the same time, it's going to protect your assets, and you're not going to be one of those stories like the Wells Fargo or you know, the Bernie Madoffs where you're getting, you want to make sure your money's protected, plus you have that extra... the extra layer of protection, the fact that we're looking at their accounts every single day and making changes on them. The other thing is we're much closer to this, so we have a lot more experience. And on the bond side, we get better pricing, we get institutional pricing, and we have a much broader inventory to choose from than a retail investor would. So in terms of managing your bond money, we're going to be able to do it at lower fees. We're going to be able to have an access to the whole spectrum of fixed income, and we're going to get better pricing, and we're going to be looking at it every day. So you don't just buy a bond and sit on it and wait till it matures. We actively trade them, and part of the reason for that is that there are opportunities when you have shifts in the yield curve, when you see movements like we did yesterday where rates were coming down a lot. We want to capitalize on that. So that's what we do best. That's how we beat the index. And again, this is our specialty. You know, this is our this is what we do. This is what we do best. And I think again, and I'm really pushing this with friends, family, and other, you know, clients. Just yes, it's exciting. Take a small piece of that and manage it yourself. But be aware that the most important thing is being able to retain that capital that you've worked so hard for and those assets that you've worked so hard for over the years. And that's, if you go in and start trading tech stocks, you know, and you try to do some day trading, yeah, you can make a little money here or there, but that game is going to end.
Yeah.
those are going to end at some point. And we can see, like we have this past week, that this is, look at how quickly we can see such a sell-off, and it could happen, it could even accelerate more. So in order to keep the lion's share of the money, the largest portion, the core portion of your money protected, we have two great strategies here that are gonna allow you to sleep at night and know that you're not gonna be, you know, taking these significant drops. Just yesterday, I'm talking to my buddy who I work out with, who's an attorney who had worked for Microsoft for many years, and he has, you know, a high position, a concentrated position in Microsoft. And he's all upset. You know, he says, I took a look at my account. You know, I've been taking my look at my account this week, and I've just realized I might have to work a few more years. And we really try to help people so they avoid that, so that they can plan when they want to retire and that they can actually retire. And they're not going to see this sudden drop in their 401k or their IRA accounts, you know, prior to their retirement. So it's a hard thing to do, because when you're making money, you don't, you know, like people have in the recent years, hard to get away from that, but you have to.
But it's very difficult even on the upside, Dan. I mean, it's the option strategies that I've been, you know, doing for, you know, an awful lot of years. They're harder to do now than I've ever, I mean, normally, I mean, we first started the Protect Index program. We started it in 1997. Between then and 2007, we ended up being money managers of the year in 2007 because, well, in those days it was easier because there was only one ETF.
Yeah.
There was a spider, and then you got the Qs. But now which ETF you pick is, you know, is incredibly important, because one's going one way and one's going the other, which is, you would never really expect, but it happens. So the first thing you do is sit down with a client and say, well, what do you really like? Because we have a lot of people in the XLV, because they think the healthcare is going to outperform, and by the way, it has recently. We had some people 2 years ago who all wanted to be all over the XLE, and that hasn't done anything, right? That's the oil piece. Even though it looked like it was going to, all of a sudden it didn't. It fizzled. We had people in the bank ETF, and that's been kind of a clunk compared to the other stuff. Russell, until recently, has been kind of a clunk. I mean, it's all really been in the seven stocks that are in the Qs and in the spiders,
yes.
And which makes it very difficult. But there's a you also to the upside. You almost can't have. I mean, like I said, between 97 and 2007, we would sell calls every month, and I'm going to say just about every month they expired worthless, and we were up when the market actually was down on the decade. Even with the protection, we were up. When the market actually, between 97 and 2007, didn't budge, right? So when we were up, you know, 11, 12% over, not a year, but we were up 11%. Nobody else was, right? Everybody else was down. So now if you have that call out there, even if you think that you know, if a stock is 150, and you sell the 60s or something, you say, well, that should be all right. Well, when the stocks move now, they go from 150 to 190. You know, and you're chasing this cost. Well, even the simplest strategies, I'm not so sure that somebody at home can do them. I mean, how do you roll them up? How do you roll them up and out? How do you defend yourself? I mean, if they all work out great, well, then it's easy. But if they don't, I mean,
it involves daily maintenance. Involves, like, being there daily. And it isn't something you can really do on the side. It just, you know, it's great that you can, you know, but in this environment in particular, it's very hard to do that when we have this level of volatility. This is where, you know, they say the pilot, when a pilot is captaining the plane, he's saying that it's during periods of turbulence and volatility that they really shine. That's what they were trained for. And, you know, maybe we've been through this smooth sail for a while, but now we're coming into more turbulence. And that's when you want the guy up front who's experienced to be taking you, you know, to be sort of guiding us to safety and then not in a very, we don't want a crash landing, let's put it that way. And we don't want a really bumpy ride on the way down. We want to continue to stay up there, and we want the person who's has all that experience to be running the plane.
We're out of time, but what do you have any? And I know it would just be speculation because I've heard. Well, it won't be if you got the call from the Japanese central bank. I guess I wouldn't be speculating. What do you make of a 3% and a 2% move in a currency in a week? We're not talking about the peso or the Brazilian something something. We're talking about the yen. That it's gone from 163 to 143 in like how many trading days? 3-4 weeks.
Yeah,
I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah, the sudden moves are really concerning, and it's especially when they come out of left field, which is exactly what we've been talking about. That there are other factors. You know, when we were saying that something's going to happen, some exogenous event or something from literally the other side of the world that was not anticipated, and that's what's going to start bringing uncertainty into the market. I think at some point that'll level off, but there is going to be an impact, and the biggest part of the impact is just sending the message to investors to stay alert. You know that this could potentially be a problem. I think in terms of U.S. currency, I'm not as concerned. I think we are the powerhouse in the financial world still, and always will be. And there's a lot of other countries that are you know have their own specific issues going on, but. Yeah, I mean, this is just a wake-up call, I think.
Well, you and I, we got a dash, but you and I would never have guessed with the wars going on, with the deficits and all the stuff, that a shock would come out of Japan. I would never.
Absolutely.
That wouldn't have been in my top 10 choices.
It's these exogenous events that come from, you know, the other side of the world that you don't anticipate, and that's what's going to shock the market and cause exactly what happened this week.
SP Futures up 43, 45. Make that. NASDAQ Futures up 225. This stuff is moving up and down during the day like I've never seen it. Dan, talk at you next week, if not before. Have a good weekend. I'll be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.